You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Welcome to episode 36 of Atheistically Speaking. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. In this episode, we have the rest of the Massimo Piliucci interview. Episode one was great, but episode two, it's even better, I think. There's more back and forth. And I was really grateful to at least get a start on a lot of the questions that I had, and I think there's more to say on that. So stick around afterwards. I've got a ton of things to say about this entire experience. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and get right back to the interview. Here it is. Let me go ahead and try to attempt to defend Sam Harris, if you don't mind.
Sure.
and feel free to pick this apart if you want. I want to first say, and I think you made this observation as well, but I'm pretty sure that though that quote is pretty damning, I want to say first off, I'm guessing you know this, but Harris does have a degree in philosophy, so he's not completely ignorant of philosophy. I believe that when he talks about the boredom that he feels for that, I don't think it's because he picked it up and dropped it. I think it's because he studied it, and then now, for whatever reason, he doesn't have an interest in it anymore.
I believe that he has an undergrad or a minor.
He has a bachelor's in philosophy. That was what he did for his undergrad. Yeah. I'm not saying he's an expert to the extent that you are or anything, but I do think that he's done a little more than just pick it up and drop it. But the only reason I say that is that I don't believe that his main battle is with philosophy. I think that it's I saw a few talks when he did this book. I actually went and saw him because I really enjoy his thinking. And I think his main concern was with losing sight of an objective morality in our society. I think that he may have inadvertently picked too big of a battle with philosophy in doing that, but I think that is what he wanted to do was say that, and you read that. I was actually going to read this, his definition of science and ask you about it, but you pretty much already covered this. He defined it elsewhere as, he said in a different article, "The remedy for all this confusion is simple. We must abandon the idea that science is distinct from the rest of human rationality. When you're adhering to the highest standards of logic and evidence, you're thinking scientifically. And when you're not, you're not."
Right.
And that's, go ahead.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. But first of all, as I said, that's not really what most people understand.
Sure. I understand.
So, right. So if you write a book, the subtitle of which is How Science Can Solve Moral Issues, you are essentially engaging in a bait and switch. You're telling your readers, hey, look, here's biology, physics, and chemistry. Yeah. And then it turns out that what you mean really is reason, discourse informed by evidence. Right?
Sure. Let me make a further defense. I was just trying to, I have a lot I wanted to say in response to what you said, trying to keep it all in my head. And what I wanted to say after that is, and this is sort of my idea, my conception of Harris's argument that I don't know that is exactly what he said, but when I read it, what I thought of is that there's really only, as far as is ought, there's really only one core ought that we have to assume in Harris's view, I think, and it's that suffering is bad. It's that we should seek to eliminate suffering and pursue well-being of conscious creatures. And I would say that 100% that is the realm of philosophy to determine, you know, how you define that, whether or not you exactly agree with that. But once you have that ought, the rest, to my mind, seems to be entirely the job of science, because it's you're trying to determine what course of action best satisfies that value. And that's an empirical question. In your article, you mentioned an example of FGM. And you said, you know, genital mutilation is wrong because it violates an individual's right to physical integrity and to avoid pain unless absolutely necessary, which is, of course is true. But that seems to me to be completely dependent on science, that last part. I mean, if medical science told us that FGM had some health benefit, then it would completely change the discussion because the changes perceive the effect on well-being that FGM would have. So that's the way I sort of look at it, that you need that. You can never fully defeat aught is just by science. I don't think that's possible. But so, if you assume one aught, you pretty much are doing science from there on out, in my mind. But am I wrong about that?
I think that's incorrect. But you are onto something. So first of all, contrary to what Harris keeps going around saying, no philosopher would say that facts are irrelevant.
Of course.
Science is irrelevant. To moral decision making, of course, it's relevant. The example that I gave you earlier of deciding about abortion is an obvious one, for instance.
Can I just quickly say?
Yeah.
I think that you're right, and I don't think he's exactly saying that. And a particular example he brings up in the book, which is why I think he's not specifically wanting to do battle with philosophers so much as other people, is a speech he saw by somebody on the ethics board. I can't remember some woman who said that, it's not wrong to do terrible things on the basis of religion because it's basically cultural relativism. She was completely called. That's what I think he was battling more so than philosophy.
That's correct. Go ahead. And that's correct. And in fact, he claims very clearly, I mean, he's very clear at the beginning of the book. He says that he's worried about two things. He's worried about religiously imposed morality. And he's right to be worried about that. And he's also worried that, so, and by the way, notice that religiously imposed morality, by the way, is a type of moral realism. It's supposed to be objective, right? I mean, whatever God says goes. Period.
And he has said that it's disturbing that, in order to find someone who believes in objective moral values, sometimes you have to look toward religious people.
Correct. So that is one of the two things he's reacting against. The second thing he's reacting against is, you mentioned it, is moral relativism. So the opposite extreme, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you have sort of religious deontology, religious, duty-based ethics, and on the other, at the opposite extreme, so you have essentially anything goes kind of moral relativism. Now, I am worried about the same two things. But what I find very bizarre in this whole discussion is that actually Harris doesn't seem, despite his undergraduate, he doesn't seem to appreciate that philosophers have come up with the best arguments by far, both against moral relativism and against religious-based morality. I mean, the best argument against religious-based morality is the Euthyphro Dilemma, which was written by Plato 2,400 years ago, and which Harris never mentions is in his book. This is a very short dialogue, a Platonic dialogue, where, Socrates has a conversation with this guy, Euthyphro, and, I won't bore you with the details, but
I'm familiar with it. I think a lot of listeners are.
But I urge your listeners to go and read it. It's a wonderful dialogue, and it established pretty much 2,400 years ago that regardless of whether gods exist or do not exist, they simply cannot be the basis for morality. You don't need science for that. It's a very good argument that has absolutely nothing to do with facts whatsoever. Now, on the other extreme of the same sort of kind of worry, there's moral relativism. And again, there too, there's a rich philosophical literature which Harris could have helped himself in criticizing, and sort of rejecting moral relativism. And so what he did was instead he cut his own legs, basically, because he could have built on the rich philosophical literature already existing and then say, and add on top of that, and by the way, there is also empirical evidence coming from the sciences about this or that or the other. Instead, he picked the approach of essentially ignoring all the philosophy came before and sort of going only with the science. Now, the problem with going only with the science is this. He can't do that. Harris starts out his book by assuming utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is a particular type of philosophical framework for moral discussions. He just assumes it. He doesn't defend it. It doesn't, it doesn't elaborate on it. He simply assumes that is the case. But any philosopher, you know, in fact, any student of philosophy, you know, ethics 101 could point out that there are actually significant issues with utilitarianism and that there are serious discussions to be had. You really have to defend a utilitarian position before you can use it as, you know, the entire basis for your approach to ethics. And it doesn't do that. It doesn't seem to realize that it's not self-evident at all that the major role of ethics is to ameliorate suffering, for instance. That's certainly one of the criteria, but it's not the only one. There's a lot of our moral decisions, for instance, have nothing to do with suffering at all. Not in the sense of pain, you know, genital mutilation or things like that. For instance, the debate that we're having as a society about gay rights, that's got nothing to do with suffering in that sense. It's got to do with rights.
I don't think that Sam Harris defined suffering in that rigid of a sense. I mean, he talked about promoting well-being, and he talked about needing to take a nuanced view to assuming that. And I think the reason he did skip that assumption is because I do believe he was focused more against moral relativism. And like you say, maybe he should have drawn more on the philosophy that goes against that in order to make his point.
Well, there's more than one way to go about moral relativism, and the utilitarian approach is only one of them. But if he does define suffering more broadly, first of all, or if he talks about well-being, let's say, you know, it's interesting that you just mentioned well-being, and he does make that analogy, right? At the beginning of the book, brings up the idea that well-being is analogous to sort of a medical, you know, to bodily well-being, right? So we go to the doctor, and even though there can be all sorts of things that may be going wrong with the human body, we know what we mean by health. A healthy human body is, you know, certain. And he draws that analogy. Interestingly, that analogy was actually invented by Aristotle. You know, it's not by Sam Harris. So this concept has been around for a long time. The problem, of course,
can I ask? I'm sorry, because I'm ignorant. What context did Aristotle, was he talking about it in the same context of Harris brings up that analogy, of course, to show that despite the fact that there's difficulty in defining well-being, there, no one doubts, you know, sort of what it is and that it's good, similarly to health. Did Aristotle, was he making that analogy for the same purpose, I wonder?
Yeah, that's exactly the same purpose. So,
really? That's so fascinating. I didn't know. Well, there you go.
So Aristotle was probably the major ancient philosopher who elaborated what is today known as virtue ethics, right? Virtue ethics is one of the three major ways of thinking about ethics. The other ones are utilitarianism, which is the one that Harris sort of assumes with our argument. And then the third one is deontology, which is sort of duty-based ethics. And duty-based ethics can be the religious in nature. I mean, if you follow the Ten Commandments, you're following rules, so you're acting deontologically. But it can also be a secular one. The major philosopher who elaborated a secular deontological code is Immanuel Kant. Now, so virtue ethics is one of the three major frameworks for ethics. There are others, by the way. There's ethics of care. There's a bunch of other there is four or five different possibilities. Now, virtue ethics, which was elaborated largely by Aristotle, is about, in fact, promoting well-being or flourishing. The Greeks had the concept was so crucial, was so fundamental for the ancient Greeks that they actually had a word for it,
eudaimonia. All right. Woohoo.
Yeah.
Score 2 points. So
eudaimonia, which literally means having a good demon. you know, it was the concept, the idea that morality for the Greeks was not about, you know, what is the right thing to do, which is the way we understand morality mostly today, but it was about what kind of life you should live. How should you live your life? What kind of eudaimonic existence? What kind of moral, you know, good life? Good in the sense of, you know, morally defensible. The kind of life that you get to the end of it and you look back and you say, yeah, that was actually, you know, I'm proud of it. It was a good thing to do. And Aristotle was very clear that it's not easy to define what eudaimonia is. Mm. There's not a single definition of eudaimonia, just like there is not a single definition of well-being in terms of, you know, the medical profession. And that's where the analogy comes from. That is, you know, the two are very much the same. There's a health of the body, and there is a health of the sort of the spirit in some sense, or a health of the mind. So in that sense, these are all good ideas which Harris elaborated on. What really is astonishing, however, from the point of view of a professional philosopher is that, you know, it just seems to act like these things did not exist before he wrote The Moral Landscape. Of course they did. There's a long history of these things, and he could have built on it. And by the way, it could have been much, much less controversial, and he could have brought to his side a lot of help from the philosophical profession by building on what had been done before, as opposed to sort of pretending like, you know, the whole thing was just not worth anything. And here we are, we have a completely new approach to things.
Let me ask you this. And sorry if I'm interrupting a point.
No, I'm
sorry. If had he written it, I'm just curious for your opinion. Had he written it with a foreword or, you know, an introduction that said something like, well, I'm sure a lot of this is, you know, a lot of this has been dealt with in philosophy, but here's my sort of, in everyday terms, look at it. If he'd written it with more of that tone, would you have as many objections to it?
I probably wouldn't, but can I tell you something? He probably would have, been much less impactful than he has been. And I'm not saying that he did that as a sort of conscious strategy, but in order to sell books or something. I mean, although there is nothing wrong with selling books, but it's not just a question of selling books or making an impact. The thing is, if you write a book. Especially these days in a modern society where, you know, everybody seems to be publishing a book every minute. And so you have to compete for an increasingly narrow market. The only way you can do that, and the only way you can have an impact, if you have, and by the way, I'm not making this up. I was actually told this by my literary agent. Okay. So this was advice from my literary agent.
Right.
You have to do the Malcolm Gladwell kind of thing. You have to come up with one simple idea and repeat it over and over throughout the book. And that's how you sell books. And that's how you have impact. Now, you have to distinguish yourself. I mean, everybody who writes a book is conscious of the fact that you need to come up with a new idea that distinguishes what you're doing from anything else that's been done before. The problem is that when you're getting into an area like ethics, where people literally have been writing stuff for 2.5 millennia, it's a little difficult to come up with something. It's not Harry's fault in that from that perspective. But yes, in answer to your question, more seriously, yes, had he taken a different tone and had he actually acknowledged and built on the literature that came before him, I am certain that not just myself, but plenty of other people would have been on board with the program and sort of built on it and not giving him that sort of hard time that he actually has encountered.
I'd like to ask, if you don't mind, you would lump Sam Harris in with those, you know, obviously you did in your article, with those who you accuse of scientism, I'm assuming. But it strikes me from what I've read and from the definition of science that you mentioned in the one that I read that Sam Harris has, aren't we talking about two different kinds of scientism here? Aren't we talking about on the one hand, there's perhaps people more like Coyne, I think, would be in this category, who just have a disdain for philosophy. And I think you've pointed out that you think Sam Harris does as well. But disregarding his quote about boredom in the universe, isn't there a difference between having a disregard for philosophy and saying, well, I'm going to go ahead and include philosophy in science? I mean, one is outright dismissal of, you know, your discipline, which I can understand would be frustrating. And the other is, you might look at it as more sinister, but it's more just a question of definitions, right? I mean, wouldn't you look at that as a little less, you know, sort of severe a scientism? I'm wondering.
Well, yeah, so that's an interesting point. First of all, actually, as it turns out, I mean, I talked to Jerry Coyne several times about this, and I actually think that Jerry, I got the impression that Jerry has actually more respect for philosophy than Harris does.
Oh, wow.
Uh, Ironic. Yeah.
I know, right? I suppose I need to read deeper. The bit I read, it didn't seem like it, but.
Occasionally it doesn't come across that way.
Okay.
But actually talking to him, and he actually, there are several essays on his blog. Why?
Well, then maybe I should have said Stenger, right? Maybe he would be a
Stenger is definitely a better
example. Okay.
Sure. Now, but let's go back to these scientism bit. Because the fundamental issue with scientism is that, and there is some truth to this, people complain, you know, people like Jerry Harris and Stenger and so on, and even Dawkins, complain about the fact that, oh, people are just throwing the label scientism whenever they don't like something that comes from science. And there is some truth to that. You know, a lot of religious apologists do that. A lot of people who are sort of on the theological side of things, they just throw around the word scientism as if it were sort of cookies to distribute around to kids. They just invoke it all the time, and that is in fact a problem. But there are actually fairly strict definitions of scientism, and there's a literature on scientism that has been sort of evolving over the last several years. In fact, we're speaking now. This week, and in a couple of days, I'm hosting a workshop on scientism at the Graduate Center of City University in New York, where we're going to have about 15 or so speakers, some of whom are more sympathetic and some of them are less sympathetic, and clearly there is a lot of discussion still on scientism and the different aspects of it, but. You can actually come up with a fairly simple definition of scientism. Here's my favorite one, comes from actually straight from the dictionary, from the Merriam-Webster. The Merriam-Webster definition of scientism is this, and I quote, "An exaggerated trust in the efficacy of the methods of natural science applied to all areas of investigation, parentheses, as in philosophy, the social sciences, and the humanities, close parentheses, unquote." So, what we're talking about here is that you engage in scientism whenever you either dismiss a non-scientific field of inquiry as irrelevant, as for instance Neil deGrasse Tyson, sure. Right? So that was an example of scientism, or when you push the claims or the approach. Of science in areas where either it doesn't belong or it doesn't really do what you think it's doing. Okay, so for instance, Harris, when you claim that science can solve moral questions, well, I think that's an example of scientism because I don't think science can solve moral questions. Science is relevant to moral questions. Scientific information is relevant to it, but as philosophers often say, underdetermines. Those choices, the facts by themselves don't tell you what to do or what not to do, or what you should do or what you should not do, but they do certainly inform, they're certainly part of it. So in that sense, I think that, yes, there are plenty of examples where the people that we've been talking about, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Sam Harris, Victor Stenger, Richard Dawkins, Jerry Coyne, they have in fact engaged in instances of scientism. Now, that doesn't mean that they all do it in the same way, nor does it mean that they all do it to the same extent. And therefore, I don't think it's particularly useful to just go around and accuse somebody of being scientistic about things. I think the most useful thing to do is to take a particular claim and see whether that claim is warranted or not. Right. So the way in which I did at the beginning of this podcast with Neil's claim about the usefulness or lack thereof of philosophy to science, that's a specific claim. And we can look at it on the merits. You can say, well, why do you expect the philosophy should be helpful to science? If it hasn't been, might there be a reason why that is the case, principled reason why that is the case? And we can perhaps make some progress in that area. I don't think it's particularly useful to just go around and throw the label scientism at random, because then it becomes sort of a meaningless phrase. There is, by the way, a better label for all of this, which sort of shields us from to some extent from the influence of the sort of theologically based crowd, and that is positivism. What these people are doing, to try to push science beyond into areas where either it doesn't belong or it's not particularly useful, it's actually the whole approach of positivism. And positivism goes back to the Enlightenment. interestingly. The word positivus was invented by Auguste Comte, who was one of the prominent philosophers, ironically, of the Enlightenment. And positivism eventually evolved into what it's called logical positivism in the early part of the 20th century in the United States. And logical positivists were famously, or even though they were philosophers, they were famously hostile to a number of philosophical pursuits, particularly metaphysics, because they thought that any statement that is not empirically verifiable is literally meaningless. Hmm. This was the famous verifiability principle of logical positivism. Of course, somebody at some point pointed out that the verifiability principle is itself not verifiable. And so you got a problem there.
Yeah. That could have been a bit of philosophy that might have made a headline. That would that could have been a pithy headline. Oh man, great discovery in philosophy. I think we got a little sidetracked, and I'm going to kick myself if I don't make sure that I think you were going to tell me how when I talked about the fact that I thought Harris only needs one ought to get, and then the rest is science. I think you were going to tell me why that was wrong, and I apologize if I missed it, but I think we got sidetracked before you went into that.
Sure. I mean, it depends on how you define, your concerns in ethics. So if your ought is simply, let's reduce human suffering, right? That clearly does not cover all of human ethical concerns. As I said, go back to my example of, gay rights. Gay rights are not about suffering. They're about positive rights, not about, the right not to suffer. Unless you, of course, define suffering itself so broadly that then it sort of becomes meaningless. But if we're talking about the kinds of suffering, genital mutilation brings about, that's one thing. If you're talking about the suffering that not being able to marry the love of your life brings about, it seems to me that those are very different kinds of suffering. So at some point, the term becomes too vague. The reason ethics is interesting and more complicated than the simple approach to one thing, one size fits all, is precisely because, as plenty of moral philosophers, including Immanuel Kant, have recognized, the issue with ethics is that often we have conflicting values. We have conflicting priorities. And when we have conflicting priorities, that's when the things become important, become interesting. Go back to the example that I gave you about half an hour ago about abortion, right? Yeah. So, I mean, unless you're really callous about the whole thing, you would have to recognize that there are, in fact, conflicting interests there. Right, there is at the very least, there is the interest of the mother in controlling her body and her reproductive abilities, and the interest of the fetus, who is in fact a potential person, at any rate, a being that is capable after a certain number of months of suffering, of feeling pain. And then, of course, there is also other interests. There is an interest of society, for instance, in keeping in sort of regulating, access or lack thereof to reproductive, capabilities, there's the interest of the father, or there is the interest of the family. I mean, there's all sorts of interests there that go into the discussion. Well,
forgive my ignorance, but when you're trying to answer that question, I mean, aren't you just trying to find the answer that has the best balance of well-being for everyone concerned? Is that too simple?
I hate to say that, but I think it's too simple.
Okay.
In that kind of situation, somebody's going to lose. Okay.
Yeah.
And so to say, well, we're going to try some middle way that sort of makes everybody happy or not too unhappy.
I'm not saying makes everybody happy. I suppose I am giving a more utilitarian answer. I mean, you're trying to do some sort of calculus. Maybe it's not precise, but you're trying to do some sort of evaluation of the most good out of the situation or the least bad, aren't you, or no?
Well, I would argue not, because, for instance, I'm I don't know if that's obvious or not. Let me state it anyway.
Pro-choice.
I am pro-choice, yeah. Right? And if you're pro-choice, you tend to actually give overriding priority to the woman's right. And utilitarians famously have a lot of trouble with the whole idea of rights. I mean, John Stuart Mill, who was one of the founders of the utilitarian movement, did talk about rights, sort of loosely speaking, but he didn't mean anything like what we mean today by that term. When we say that somebody has a right to do that and that right trumps other considerations, we're really outside of utilitarian calculus.
But can't I ask why you would give that right that preference? I mean, when you're making that decision, when you personally being pro-choice, I am too, of course. I'll just speak for myself. When I'm making that decision to be pro-choice, it's because I believe that more harm is caused by not allowing women the right to do that than is caused by, you know, aborting the fetus. Maybe I just need to read more moral philosophy, but I still feel like I'm making the choice based on what I think is the best calculation of well-being for everybody.
I don't think you are, honestly.
Okay.
And for a couple of reasons. First of all, because, you know, if I were to take you at your word, then I would like to see that calculation. I mean, how are you making that calculation?
Well, I use the word calculation, yeah. I'm not talking math. I mean, I wouldn't defend that, but I don't know how else to make that judgment other than to take what I think is going to do the most good and go with that. And for me, I think what does the most good is allowing women the right to have an abortion, because given all of the different factors, like you said, societal, I mean, I think what's best for everybody. And if I didn't think that, then I wouldn't be pro-choice. I mean, if I thought that there was more harm from abortion somehow, then I wouldn't be pro-choice.
Forgive me to push back a little. If I push
no,
back
go ahead. I really am curious. Like what? I'm missing something.
Well, what's happening there is that you're basically rephrasing. You know, you're saying, you know, I'm making the decision that does the most good. But when I ask you, well, how do you cash in that idea of most good? You don't really, you immediately say, well, this is not a calculation. This is not an, you know, I don't have a quantification there. Well, if you don't have a quantification, then you're not really talking about the most good. You're simply talking about, which is, by the way I think about it. So we agree on the specifics, right? What you're doing there is you're saying, okay, there are competing moral stances here. And I think that one overrides the others. For whatever reason, and you need to, of course, if we're talking about having a serious ethical discussion, then you need to also elaborate, you know, to articulate why you think that the right of the mother trumps the right of anybody else,
well,
the fetus, the society at large, the family, the father, and all that sort of stuff. And frankly, it's not that easy to articulate that sort of reasoning.
I don't think it is easy, but I don't know that means that I'm not trying to do that calculation.
Well, I would invite you to try to actually, you know, spell it out.
I will try briefly, just quickly. I mean, when I think of it I'm just answering for me personally, when I think about abortion rights, I think that a fetus has less capacity for feeling. It has less at stake because it's not aware, or likely not aware. I mean, if science told me that it was, a fetus was completely aware somehow, at a given age, then it would completely change the pseudo calculation that I'm possibly failing at making.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, that's true. Now that is true. But of course the calculation cannot possibly end there, right? I mean,
I was going to go on. First thing. I think that, for a grown woman, or, you know, however grown the woman would be, that they have more at stake and there's more harm that would be done by forcing them to change their life and to raise a child that they might not want. And also not to mention the fact that the child could be raised in a situation that it's not wanted in or not ideal. I think that in my mind, and maybe I'm not doing a great calculation, I don't know, but that's what I feel like I'm doing. I feel like I the net good is greater for allowing abortion. That's what I feel like I'm doing.
I don't think one can actually make that calculation. I think that with the reason we agree and we're both, pro-choice is actually because we are convinced that the right of an individual whose body it is, essentially, that we're talking about, sort of trumps everything else in this context, even though actually one could make the argument that Well, as far as society at large is concerned, or as far as, you know, the very distant future of the fetus once it becomes an adult human being, or the rights, the combined rights of the fetus and the family and the father, let's say, or something like that. I mean, that if it were actually to do a calculation somehow, I mean, I don't think it's possible. But that's one of the problems with utilitarianism, that, you know, it's just, it turns out it's not possible to do that kind of calculations. There's no such a thing as the utility calculus, unfortunately, or fortunately. I don't know, actually. It may be a good thing that there is no such a thing, but yeah. I don't think there is such a thing. And therefore, that's where I think utilitarianism actually falls down. And now, if you want to be a utilitarian about these kind of arguments, and there are very sophisticated utilitarians today. I mean, Peter Singer, for instance, is arguably the most prominent utilitarian alive today. And he's very, very good at making sort of that sort of argument. But a lot of people, who have thought about these kind of things for long and hard, actually recognize that whenever you're talking about rights, trumping somebody else's rights, or trumping this kind of situation, you're really already putting yourself pretty much outside of utilitarianism. You're talking either about some kind of deontological approach. Rights go very well with deontology. With duty-based ethics, basically, and, you know, you have a duty to respect the bodily integrity of the mother, or they actually work very well also with virtue ethics, because virtue ethics is about, you know, the character of the individual and, you know, the moral character of the individual. So it's about it's about the moral integrity of the person, not about, you know, necessarily a particular decision or not. So, for instance, virtue ethicists are perfectly fine with the idea that a woman may make the moral decision at some point to abort, and another point in her life not to abort. From a deontological perspective, that's hard to understand. You know, how can you possibly make a decision in one case and in one way, and the other case in the other way, and think that they're both right? Well, they are, because situations are different, because the moral situation is different, the life situation is different. So the point is, you know, I don't want to belabor the point, but the idea is that when somebody says, I'm weighing all the, the contrasting options, that is a metaphor. That's metaphorically, that is what you're doing. But you're not doing that in the utilitarian sense of the term. You're not actually weighing anything. You're not actually calculating anything. You're saying, look, there are these contrasting values here, and I have some reasons which I can articulate for why this particular value trumps the others. And that is, by the way, precisely what moral philosophy is about. I mean, ethical reasoning is precisely about working out the why and how of these kinds of situations. And notice that a lot of these decisions are actually largely, not entirely, but largely independent of the facts. I mean, one of the best ethical arguments in favor of the right of a woman to control her body is actually a thought experiment that was proposed by a philosopher a number of years ago. And this is the famous violinist thought experiment. This idea is, imagine that you're an adult individual human being and you're kidnapped one day by this society of musically inclined people. And they, unbeknownst to you, they attach to your body this violinist who is about to die, and his only chances of surviving are to stay attached to your body for 9 months. Okay. Now the violinist is not a fetus; he's an adult. He's an independent human being, sentient, just with a life as rich as yours, and so on and so forth. And the question is, you know, do you have a moral right? A moral obligation, basically, to confine yourself for 9 months in bed so that the violinist can survive. And the paper, this is a classic paper in moral philosophy, argues that actually you don't have that moral duty. Mm-hmm. It would be nice if you did, okay? I mean, you can be nice to the violinist and say, hey, okay, I am going to, you know, be immobilized for 9 months of my life just to save your life. That would be a nice thing to do. Nobody would argue that wouldn't be the case. But the article argues very nicely and in good detail that you do not have a moral duty to do so.
I'm very curious to read that, but yeah. Just off the top of my Please, just off the top of my head, though, I mean, doesn't that only talk about abortion in the situation of rape? I mean, does it not at all change if you made the decision to have this violinist attached to you? I mean, does that not change it at all? Because I mean, in the thought experiment, it sounds forcible to me.
It's forced, right? Yeah. That's right. Yes, but the point, yes, that's a good point. But the point of the experiment is the violinist in question is, of course, not a fetus, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't say, this is a being that is, only potentially a human being. It's, maybe it doesn't even feel pain, that sort of stuff. The idea is that you're posed all of a sudden in a situation where you have a fully sentient, fully operational human being whose life depends on you. And if under those circumstances, you do not have a moral duty to keep him alive, then even more so, you don't have, that's the idea, even more so, you don't have a moral duty to keep alive a fetus. It's, just like every thought experiment, of course, there are some analogies and some disanalogies. So yes, you can argue about, the forced situation versus non-forced situation. But I'll send you the article. It's a very good example.
Because I was actually going, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Because I was actually, oddly enough, I was going to try to say something like that because I've never viewed, and I'm sorry to test your patience on this whole thing, but I've never viewed the issue of abortion in those terms, really. I've always thought, and maybe I've been looking at this incorrectly, I've always thought that if it were determined that the fetus was a person, then I wouldn't support aborting, killing a person. I've never looked at it as... a right to control their body because if it's not their body, then it's, I don't think they should, like, for example, I mean, do you support abortion, when the baby is completely fully formed and in many cases could have already been delivered? I mean, do you still support it then or?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I mean, what you're saying is essentially that the problem here is one of gradations, right? That is, there is less and less of a problem if we're talking about earlier and earlier stages in the pregnancy, and there is more and more of an issue, of a moral issue, if you get later and later in the pregnancy.
I'd say so. Sure. I say the problem is, I've always thought of it this way, and maybe I'm wrong, but I've always thought that it's less about a right to choose and more about when, via whatever method we are using, when we have decided the child is a human. Because you can't, there's no amount of choice that gives you a right to murder someone. In an innocent person. So I've always looked at it that way. Maybe I'm wrong in how I'm looking at that. I don't know.
Right. But first of all, I actually think it's pretty clear that the majority of the discussion, the most of the discussion about abortion actually is about a woman's ability to control her body, not about, whether the fetus is or is not a person. I mean, the issue of whether the fetus is or is not a person is usually a theological objection to abortion, but the counter objection there is it doesn't matter whether it is what do you define as a person or not.
Right, and that's why I'm really curious to read. I don't know if you think that paper elaborates on that because I say that, I'm not saying that I've viewed the popular debate this way. I'm saying that's how I look at it, and I've always found the popular debate to be sort of annoying when you have one side saying, "Oh, I'm pro-life," and the other's pro-choice when those aren't. It's a false dichotomy. In terms of the names, I've always looked at the problem. So when I said that, I don't mean to say I think that's how everyone looks at it.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I'm very curious to read that. So okay, I think I've taken too much of your time already, and I had a ton more I wanted to ask you about. I would really love if sometime later you'd come back, but we'll see if we can make that happen because I had a lot more on scientism and you said it was a conference on scientism, right? What?
Yes, correct. At City University in New York at the Graduate Center, just this week.
This week?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I meant to tell you this will be airing, it's a bit of a delay cause it's it is a show I edit and all that. This will be airing in a few weeks. So, this will have already happened. Yes. So how did it go?
Oh, it went beautiful.
So
what's going to happen actually is that, you know, the conference is co-organized by myself and a colleague at Ghent University in Belgium, Martin Baudry. And Martin and I are thinking of putting together an edited volume that sort of collects papers from the conference. So maybe when the volume comes up, we can, you know, come back and talk about it.
Oh, that would be excellent. I will read that thing front to back because I find it to be a very interesting topic, and I would love to have you back to ask you some more questions.
Sounds good.
So thank you so much for joining me, Massimo, and thanks and have a great night.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Man, what an intellect on that guy. It was just really hard not to just want him to speak the entire time nonstop because he's so good at gathering his thoughts instantly in real time and making a bunch of different points and, you know, keeping it all in his head. And he doesn't miss a second. He just keeps right on going. It's really impressive. I wish I had half of that ability. I want to thank him again so much for coming on. It was outstanding. He gave me a lot to think about, and though I think I made a few good points at the time, I definitely needed to read up on a few things and consider the points he made more carefully. But having done that, and to a decent extent, I have a number of thoughts on scientism and some of the other things we discussed. First, I want to say I think his article about Tyson is pretty much right on. I think I somewhat understand and sympathize with where Neil deGrasse Tyson is coming from, and I think that humanity is probably better off if a brilliant person goes into science rather than philosophy. But Pigliucci made some excellent points and definitely has me convinced that Neil Tyson goes too far in his dismissal of philosophy. I agree with Massimo that society is in a rough place if we only pursue science or anything else that might save lives and completely abandon things like the arts or whatever. However, one thing I could have challenged him on more is that Tyson would likely say that there at least is some entertainment and plenty of other value to humans for art, whereas if Tyson is right about philosophy, it does very little to benefit anyone else and is really just sort of mind puzzles for other philosophers to solve and toil with. I suppose I'll just ask you guys, if the next great genius is about to graduate from high school and pick a college major, what would you hope? And I'm, for the sake of the next several sentences, I'm just going to pick she. Saying he or she every time would get really annoying, especially with possessives and such. But saying he, if I just assumed the next great genius was a he, then I'm sure I would get in a lot of trouble for that. So I'm just going to say she. Why not? So anyway, if the next great genius is just graduating high school, going to pick a college major, what would you hope that she was going to pick? Because personally, I would hope it would be a scientific field or where she could make a medical advance or maybe or another scientific field where she could further our understanding of nature or revolutionize space travel or something like that. But on the other hand, if we're all just going to die eventually anyway, maybe this genius ought to be the next great, you know, songwriter or screenwriter, or, you know, director or something like that. I don't know. Make an artistic contribution that will affect people forever. I personally, and all apologies to Pigliucci, I personally wouldn't pick philosophy very early in the field of study fantasy draft here, if we're talking about the next great genius. But I just don't know that there's enough significant work left to be done for that not to be sort of a waste of talent. Now, I love philosophy. I really do. I don't know. That's kind of how I feel. I would never say that it's dead. I wouldn't say that it's useless and none of those things, but I still would think we'd be missing out a little bit if the next great genius went into philosophy. I don't, but who knows? I guess the only real answer though is maybe maybe the next great genius would unlock territory we didn't even imagine in philosophy. And maybe we ought to just leave it to this genius to decide. After all, if this hypothetical genius, is really the hypothetical genius I'm making her out to be, She ought to be able to determine who is right in this little debate out of Neil deGrasse Tyson or Pigliucci. So I'll trust her on that. But no, I do think that Tyson goes a little too far in the bad things he says about philosophy. I think that Massimo had some great points on that. Moving on from that, though, I'd like to discuss scientism and, of course, Sam Harris, because that was kind of the focus of our talk. After hearing what I have to say, I'm sure you guys could accuse me of being too much of a Harris fan, but I do want to tell you that I left this interview, this recording, feeling pretty down on Sam Harris. I really did, but then when I was researching a lot more on what I was going to say for this, I think that maybe Massimo was a little too hard on him. While it does seem like there's a lot Harris could have done to make his book less offensive to philosophers, I think he could have been more diplomatic in what he wrote, certainly. I think that his treatment of philosophy is not as egregious as Pigliucci made it out to be. There's a lot of accusations Massimo leveled against Harris. At one point he says that Harris says we don't need philosophy at all. But I think the problem is that Massimo sees Harris's claim that science can determine moral values as, if he were to extend it, I think this is what Massimo thinks. He thinks it's science can determine moral values better than philosophy. I strongly believe that's what Massimo's thinking. However, I really think that what Harris actually means to say, if the troublesome subtitle were expanded a bit, is contrary to the belief that they are completely relative, science can determine moral values. That's what I think Harris means. I don't think he means that science is better than philosophy somehow at determining moral values. So I just want to play this little quote from Massimo just to sort of get back in touch with what he was saying and deal with it.
I mean, if you are running a book that takes on a field that so far for the last, you know, two millennia has been the province of a particular area of inquiry, philosophy, and you claim that that area of inquiry has nothing more to say about it and you have a better idea, you ought to morally ought to engage that area of inquiry very carefully, show why you think it doesn't have anything else to say about the topic, and then move on and propose your idea. I mean, it's just not serious writing if you say, oh, I'm not going to talk about this whole thing because I get bored by it.
So I actually think that Massimo is slightly sort of misrepresenting what Harris said in this note. So I have it right here. It might be a little long, but bear with me. This is the note, chapter one, note one. Many of my critics fault me for not engaging more directly with the academic literature on moral philosophy. This seems to be exactly what Massimo is doing. There are two reasons why I haven't done this. First, while I have read a fair amount of this literature, I did not arrive at my position on the relationship between human values and the rest of human knowledge by reading the work of moral philosophers. I came to it by considering the logical implications of our making continued progress in the science of mind. Secondly, I'm convinced that every appearance of the, and this is sort of the, what Massimo sees as the troublesome quote here, I'm convinced that every appearance of terms like metaethics, deontology, non-cognitivism, and anti-realism, emotivism, etc., directly increases the amount of boredom in the universe. My goal, both in speaking at conferences like TED and in writing this book, is to start a conversation that a wider audience can engage with and find helpful. Few things would make this goal harder to achieve than for me to speak and write like an academic philosopher. Of course, some discussion of philosophy will be unavoidable, but my approach is to generally make an end run around many of the views and conceptual distinctions that make academic discussions of human values so inaccessible. While this is guaranteed to annoy a few people, the professional philosophers I've consulted seem to understand and support what I'm doing. So to me, when I read that, it seems as though Harris, he wasn't quite saying, and I couldn't quite remember enough to challenge Massimo on this at the time, because I also just remembered the, oh, it increases the boredom of the universe part. But it seems as though what Harris is saying here is that most people find this philosophy boring. He may or may not find it boring, but maybe he does. But what's important is that he thinks in order to engage a wider audience in a discussion on moral truth, he needs to avoid these terms. If Pigliucci wants to disagree with this, he's entirely free to. But I'm not entirely convinced that Pigliucci is arguing against the correct thing here. Ask yourself, if you were trying to reach a wide audience, would you want to be using terms like deontology, non-cognitivism, etc.? I highly doubt that most people would be able to sit through a talk or a book like that. Because, you know, anyone I know, just thinking in my life, I mean, I can hardly get, if you're trying to reach a wide audience, I mean, I can hardly get anyone at work to talk about these issues to begin with, much less when I get into, you know, really deep, like philosophical terms. So I think that that's a different debate. And Harris is not, you know, he's saying that he did it this way in order to appeal to more people. So I think that Massimo should probably engage the argument from the, if he wants to argue with it, at least be arguing with the right thing. So now let's talk Plato and Aristotle. Massimo said Harris ignored the Euthyphro dilemma when he could have used it to easily show that religion shouldn't determine morality. And to Massimo, this is sort of another, you know, strike against Harris in that he just ignored this philosophy that he easily could have used. Now, my problem with Pigliucci's claim here is that I don't think Harris was really all that worried about having to prove this particular thing, the same thing that the Euthyphro dilemma proves. From what I remember and from going through this book, I didn't have time to reread the entire book just for this episode. I wish I did, but I reread as much as I could. And from that, I think Harris pretty much just accepts it as a given that we shouldn't use religion to determine morality. He seems far more concerned with combating the idea of moral relativism. I tried to say that to Pigliucci and he didn't really buy it, but I really think that is Sam Harris's problem. Moral relativism is his main problem. Now I'm open to the idea that Sam Harris could have availed himself more of modern day moral philosophy to make some of these points. That's fine. There's another time where the only thing is, I think Massimo's reading of Harris's intentions is a little off. Massimo said that philosophy has provided the best refutations of moral relativism instead of science. But remember, Harris defined science to include much of philosophy. Now, I know, look, a lot of you that are really anti-scientism, I get it. You can completely disagree with Harris's wide definition of science here if you want. That's totally fine. And that's another discussion. But you have to accept that that's the premise he's working from. Once you see that, then the criticism here doesn't really make that much sense, because really, Harris is including philosophy and science. So if Massimo is saying, you know, Harris is saying that science does it instead of philosophy, that doesn't make sense. That's not really what Harris is claiming. Now, as far as Aristotle is concerned, this was pretty troubling to me. I don't know if you guys remember. I think it would have been in this episode because I had to split it in two. Yeah, I think it was this one. I left this interview feeling like Harris essentially plagiarized Aristotle. And even worse, did so in a book that was also completely trashing philosophy. Now, I now don't entirely think this is the case. The analogy in question, I remember well from hearing Sam Harris talk about it and stuff, is one that he used to show that just because the concept of well-being isn't easily defined doesn't mean that seeking it is impossible, or that any two methods of seeking well-being are going to be the same, just because you can't easily and clearly perfectly define well-being. And so by comparison, by analogy, he said, consider health. Essentially, what it says is that health is not exactly easy to define. You know, it's sort of relative to your current state. It's not exactly the same for everyone. But this doesn't undermine all of medicine in the way that some people think, because you can't define well-being, you can't, you know, have a science of morality. So that's the point he's making. No one would say, you know, that all medicine is relative because of this. So Pigliucci pretty much led me to believe that this analogy was lifted straight from Aristotle. I can't 100% say that he's wrong, and I would trust his knowledge over mine, but I did my best to Google this and to find anything I could see relating to it, and I can't find anything. And further, based on our discussion, it seems like Pigliucci is maybe not talking about exactly the same thing. I think he might be referring to maybe when Aristotle was trying to define eudaimonia and he made some, you know, comparison to health, but I don't know. I just can't find it, but I'm really open to evidence on this. So if anyone listening can throw me a link to what Massimo might've been referring to, I'd love to see it. Further, I noticed another note when I was looking at the other notes I wanted to look at in the book, that makes it to me even more unlikely that Harris, you know, knowingly lifted this analogy. On a note that corresponds to this very analogy we're talking about, it says, I recently had the pleasure of hearing the philosopher Patricia Churchland draw this same analogy. Patricia, I did not steal it. So that would be very odd if he knowingly lifted it from Aristotle and then saw someone else using it and then said, like, no, I came up with it. Like, that would be really, I just don't think he would do that. So I don't know. I kind of doubt what Pigliucci was saying here, but of course I'm really open to seeing what example Massimo might've been talking about here. And to make a final point on Harris and Aristotle, I'll read another note. I am not the first person to argue that morality can and should be integrated with our scientific understanding of the natural world. Of late, philosophers William Casebeer, I don't know if that's Casebeer or something, and Owen Flanagan have each built similar cases. And he references their books. Both Casebeer, and Flanagan have resurrected Aristotle's concept of eudaimonia, which you know shows that Harris at least has this much knowledge, and he does have a bachelor in philosophy, as I pointed out. So a bachelor's, so he must be pretty familiar with this basic stuff, which is generally eudaimonia, which is generally translated as flourishing or fulfillment or well-being. While I rely heavily on these English equivalents, I've elected not to pay any attention to Aristotle. This is something that Massimo would probably not like. But he says, while much of what Aristotle wrote in his Nicomachean Ethics is of great interest and convergent with the case I wish to make, some of it isn't, and I'd rather not be beholden to the quirks of the great man's philosophy. Both Casebeer and Flanagan, it can't be Casebeer. That's too, if it is, that's a cool, he must have really had an easy time in, fraternities, but in college. Casebeer and Flanagan also seem to place greater emphasis on morality as a skill and a form. So it goes on. Maybe this wasn't important, but I wanted to point out, he says at the end here, in any case, both Casebeer and Flanagan go into greater philosophical detail than I have on many points, and both their books are well worth reading. Flanagan also has offered very helpful notes on an early draft of this book. So that doesn't sound like someone who's disregarding philosophy. I mean, he's referencing two philosophers. He's saying, check out their books. They've done a better job on this particular thing than I care to do here. And he says also one of them, you know, was heavily involved in the, you know, drafting or the, you know, the first draft of this book. So, you know, I don't know. I just think that it seems more likely to me that Harris simply wanted to do his best to make a case for moral truth, divorced from religion, and a case that would appeal to the most people. And he also claimed that he arrived at these conclusions by himself and not really as a result of reading moral philosophy. And I'm fine with taking his word on that. He could be lying, but to me, it's not important. I mean, he's trying to make a case that will appeal to more people and is more plain language, I think. I don't think he is saying that all philosophy is wrong and I'm, you know, his version is right. So I just think Pigliucci's main problem really seems to be the bait and switch. And I agree with that to a certain extent. I think that he subtitled the book, Sam Harris subtitled the book a little inaccurately. And I don't know if that was him or the, you know, oftentimes, as we've learned, authors don't get to choose their own titles. So that's fine. That's a valid criticism. However, if Harris really wrote this book with the intention of trashing philosophy and replacing it with science, I really don't think he would have gone to the trouble of defining science to include philosophy. It is completely reasonable to argue with his definition. Again, I'll say it again. I mean, that's totally reasonable. And Massimo did, I think, and that I totally understand. if anything, if Sam Harris is guilty of thinking science is the best and maybe only way of knowing, and he also tries to define philosophy as under the umbrella of science, doesn't that mean he views philosophy in a positive way? By analogy, if I wrote a book with a purpose, like my purpose was wanting to say science is far better than, say, divination at predicting things about the world or something. Divination is just crap. Like, if that's what I want to write. And then in a little note, I say, oh, I'm of course defining science to include divination. That wouldn't really make much sense. And that's sort of the same thing going on here. To me, this proves that this was not the purpose of the moral landscape. He was rather more concerned with fighting the notion of moral relativism. All right, so that's my take on it. I love Pigliucci. He was great on the show. I disagree with some things, as I've said, and I think he's not exactly fair to Sam Harris in some ways, but I understand where a lot of it comes from, and I think he's very fair in a lot of his other critiques of other scientismists. Yeah, and also I have a lot more I'd love to ask him on morality. I did read the paper on abortion that he recommended. He emailed it to me afterwards. Great, man, he's such a cool guy. He just emailed me right back afterwards and said, oh, here it is, thanks for the show and everything like that. So he's a fantastic guest. I would love to have him on again anytime. And maybe I can ask him some of these challenges, and I'm sure he'd have a good response to them. So, a lot more on morality. I'm out of time for now. I'm over time, I think, for this episode. So it's that time where I'm going to have to thank my Patreons. So I got to thank my greatest people ever, Havard, Jonathan Moyer, John P. and Bangs Naughty Bits. You guys are just the best. I can't even say. It's so great. And my $5 supporters, Cincy Farmer, Jeremy Sharp, and Matt Garrett. And also, I'm thanking him anyway. He signed on as no reward. I didn't even know you could do that, but he's doing $5, but he elected to not have a reward. So his name's Jim. Thank you so much, Jim. I'm sure you didn't want to be thanked, but I don't care. Your last name's not there, so no one will know. No one will know it's you, but thank you so much. I can't tell you how much it means to me that you guys support me. And I really, that's right. I don't know if anyone has made it through this far, but the bonus material this week is a review of the movie The Unbelievers with Tracy Moody. We're both going to watch it and give our take on that. So that should be very fun. I know a lot of you, I'm sure, would love to see that movie. So that no spoilers. I don't know if there's any like spoilers to it or anything, but we'll see. So that'll be the bonus content for this week. It'll be, of course, about a full episode worth. Don't worry. So that should be great. And thank you again. And of course, go on to patreon.com/atheist if you want to get in on that. If not, that's okay too. You'll just have to keep hearing these plugs. So thanks guys for another great week. And I will see you next week.